Okay, yeah. Well, thank you all for finding the room at the far end of the hall. This is the panel on natural gas pipelines. In recent years, we've seen controversy over fracking or shale gas development shift to controversy over gas pipelines, and today we want to dig into that. We've got a great panel of experts here. So the way we're going to do the panel is we'll have 45 minutes of discussion between, you know, our panelists up here, and then we want to leave at least half an hour at the end for questions from you guys. We'll give priority to the folks with blue badges, the journalists and SEJ members. My name is Lisa Hymas. I'm the director of the Climate and Energy Program at Media Matters for America, which is a nonprofit media watchdog based in Washington, D.C. And I'll introduce our panelists briefly. If you want to read more about them, they have longer bios online. And then we'll jump right in. So right here to my left is Brooke Harper. She's our activist. She is the Maryland and D.C. Policy Director for the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. And that's a grassroots nonprofit that works on solutions to climate change in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. And she worked previously as an organizer for nonprofits and political campaigns. To her left is Marie Cusick, our journalist today. She's an award-winning reporter with State Impact Pennsylvania, a public media partnership between WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia. She covers policy around energy and environmental issues with a focus on Marcellus Shale natural gas development, and her work often airs on national NPR programs. To her left is Rob Bulware. He's our industry voice today. He's director of stakeholder relations at Seneca Resources Corporation, a subsidiary of the National Fuel Gas Company. Seneca develops natural gas in the Marcellus and Utica shale regions, among others. He also previously worked at the Marcellus Shale Coalition as program director. And fun fact, he owns a low-till farm near here, he mentioned to me last night. And to the far left is Ken Clemow. He's our scientist. He's a professor of biology and geoenvironmental science at Wilkes University here in Pennsylvania. And he also directs the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research at the university. He's done some really interesting research on the ecological impacts of pipelines, which we'll hear about. And he also served a couple of years ago on Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf's Natural Gas Pipeline Infrastructure Task Force, which we'll be interested to hear about. Let's see. So to kick things off, Marie did a fun piece for NPR's Morning Edition a couple of years ago about how the very word fracking stirs up controversy. People can't even agree on how to spell it, let alone what it means or how or if it should be done. So, Marie, I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit about that piece and about the technical definition of fracking, so we're all kind of starting from the same place with the words we're using.
Good morning. I like to start presentations with this discussion around the word fracking. It was added to the dictionary 3 years ago, and technically it means the injection of fluids at high pressure to release oil and gas from shale beds or something like that. But I think that's important to start off with, because when you talk about fracking, the industry really talks about that actual process of hydraulically fracturing a well. And sometimes in the public domain or in journalism, we use the word to sort of mean everything related to shale development. So, you know, there's fracking trucks, there's fracking wells, there's the frackers, you know, fracked gas from a pipeline. They actually have not added the adjective fracked yet. So there is no such thing as fracked gas, according to the dictionary folks. I checked with them this week. They're probably going to add it soon. But I just, like, just so people understand that in the public discourse, it's often used as everything to do with shale development. And so that's where some of the confusion and controversy can come around. And it was first used in an industry journal in 1953. And it was spelled with a K, so the K was not added to make it look like the F word, because that comes up sometimes. So just starting off with that.
Okay, thank you. Let's see. So I wanted to dive in with Brooke here. I'm wondering if you can tell us how your group, which focuses on climate change, how you view natural gas development in the context of climate change. So I know Brooke worked on the campaign to push Maryland Governor Larry Hogan toward banning fracking, which he did in the spring. And you've been involved in fighting a gas pipeline that would run under the Potomac River, the Eastern Panhandle Pipeline Expansion Project. So how do you see these projects and this issue connecting to climate change and climate action?
So we see these projects as keeping us locked into the fossil fuel industry and not letting us move forward on clean energy solutions and renewable energy like wind and solar. And by concentrating more of the frack gas infrastructure in our states and throughout our country, we see it as actually moving us backwards and not forwards. We used to see even some of our greatest environmental champions in the Maryland Assembly used to see natural gas as a bridge fuel and something that would help us to transition as we move to more renewable energy sources like wind and solar. But after seeing the research that has come out and all of the adverse health and environmental impacts, we really have just a keep-it-in-the-ground philosophy. And seeing families across our state who lived with, in my home state of Maryland, who lived with uncertainty of whether they should expand their businesses or invest in a second home and do all of those things in our state, we really saw it as not only hindering climate change, but also hindering people's livelihoods and their lives and their future generations.
Okay. Rob, I'm guessing you might have a different perspective on this. So maybe you could tell us how you or how Seneca Resources views the challenge of climate change. And, you know, Marie mentioned that some people talk about natural gas as a bridge fuel. Do you guys see natural gas as a bridge fuel to a renewable energy future? How does Seneca approach these issues?
Well, I think when you look at natural gas, first off, we can't convert to zero. I hear that term all the time about that we're going to be zero carbon fuels. At some point in the future, don't know what that will hold, but when you look at something such as how solar panels are constructed, I mean, the first half of a solar panel's life is done with carbon fuels, and there's really not much way you're going to do it right now with today's technology to do it differently. It's extracted with steam shovels. It's driven by trucks. The sand has to be converted to silica, which is a heat process. It has to be precise heat, and that's derived by carbon fuels. So I sometimes will tell folks, at least we need to drill enough just to get that particular part of the process. Even making a windmill is a heat process. So you still will need a certain level of carbon fuels. When you think about things such as the coating on this cord or the coating on the plastic that runs through your homes for electricity, that is also derived from a petrochemical that comes out of the same well that methane comes from for natural gas. So again, until there are replacement substances, there needs to be a certain level of natural gas or carbon activity related to energy production, energy use. I think we can have an open dialogue because it probably should be a good mix of a portfolio of energy. I've had conversations with folks on the nuclear side, and they advocate for nuclear energy as being clean and available, but they'll also say the reason why they don't do it publicly is because you'll get hit in the head with it. But that's not a good reason to have no policy surrounding it. So I think if we actually looked at it collectively, and the country doesn't have a national energy policy, that you would have a mix of items in that portfolio, which would include natural gas and probably some coal and nuclear and wind and solar and a variety, and you use it where it takes place. To the comment about infrastructure, and I often do wonder from that particular perspective that when you put a solar farm or a wind farm, specifically a wind farm, you typically want to put it on the apex at your highest point because you're going to capture the wind, and you would have a right-of-way with power lines bringing that energy back to where the consumers are. So just like you have a pipeline right away, at least that aspect of it from land disturbance sometimes gets lost, that you still will have infrastructure that's associated with your alternative fuel sources.
So there's a lot there. I think we'll dig back into some of those issues. But for a minute, I want to turn to Ken. You've done some research on pipelines and their ecological impacts. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that work and what you've been finding.
Sure, absolutely. So I've been doing research on looking at the impact of natural gas development and pipelines and their ecological impact. And basically, the research that I've done has been along two main threads. One thread of research has been looking at stream macroinvertebrates, which are little insects that live in the water. And many of you might know that there are some macroinvertebrates that like to live in clean water, and there are other macroinvertebrates that prefer or can do well in more polluted water. And so many times whenever we look at stream water quality, in addition to taking water quality samples and looking for ions, you know, things like nitrate and phosphate and other kinds of ions, you know, we also look at the bugs in the water, and the bugs in the water often tell us a lot more than our chemical analyses will. And so one of the areas of research that I did, actually we were funded by the Department of Energy, was looking at macroinvertebrates in northeastern Pennsylvania streams. And we were looking at it from, to one degree, looking at it from the perspective of does natural gas development impact stream macroinvertebrates. But then on the other hand, we also wanted to look at other influences within the watershed that would include things like farming and urbanization and coal mining and other kinds of impacts. And so for there, and our results are still yet we're trying to get the results published, but it seems that probably the biggest impact on the macroinvertebrates, at least, has been caused by natural gas pipelines. And we could talk about why pipelines are an impactor there. So that actually got me interested in pipelines as a specific set of impacts related to natural gas development. And so what I'm doing now with a group of students is that we're looking at revegetation. And so I'm a plant ecologist, so I focus mainly on the plants that grow out in the environment. And we're looking mainly at the degree to which we have native versus alien species that are found on these natural gas pipelines, and also looking at the process of revegetation, especially at some of the newer pipelines versus the older pipelines. And for there, what we found, and again, the results are still being written up and will be submitted for publication, but what we found there is that at least in the older pipelines, to our great surprise, we have actually mainly native species in some of the older pipelines. The newer pipelines, though, it seems that it is mainly alien species. And so what we're trying to find then is what goes on in the process of going from a newer pipeline to an older pipeline to switch the ecosystem more from a alien ecosystem to a native ecosystem.
Okay, great. Thanks. So, Marie, you've reported on a lot of gas pipeline projects in this region and other gas infrastructure projects. What are some of the challenges for journalists as they're digging into these stories and trying to get them right and tell them accurately?
Yeah, I think the hardest thing is there are so many projects. It's hard to keep them all straight. So maps are great if you're able to do that as a journalist and you have a good visual team to help map what the projects look like so people can get a sense of the scope. I also think when it comes to the controversy, there's a lot of different controversies. There's climate change, there's private property rights, there's local environmental impacts. So you just need to understand when you're covering a protest or talking to somebody who's opposed to a pipeline, well, what is their specific concern? They're also regulated, I would say, by an alphabet soup of agencies. So it can be hard to keep that all straight too when you're reporting on a pipeline. When you're talking about interstate natural gas pipelines, mostly it's regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC. So to the extent you can try to just dig in with FERC and the other state-level agencies that permit various things and keep that all straight. And other challenges, I mean, I guess I was not, you know, I didn't cover anything out in Standing Rock or that whole situation, but at least where I live in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, it looks like there may be sort of an impending clash between law enforcement and protesters soon around the Atlantic Sunrise gas pipeline. So I would say, you know, my advice would be just try, if you're going to get into one of these situations, try to connect with everyone early and just get to know who's who with law enforcement, the companies involved, the activists. But yeah, it's just, there's a lot of projects, there's a lot going on, there's a lot of different voices and different concerns, and also just putting it in context, because it's not just the pipeline, right? It's, there's the production, the development upstream. The intense focus now is on midstream, these pipelines, because they're being built, but I think it's important to explain to people also where it's going. How is it being used in power plants? Is it being exported? Is it going to fuel manufacturing facilities? So that would be my advice, if you're covering it, to just, you know, put it in context, understand the regulatory agencies, and understand the different issues involved and the diverse voices and concerns.
I'm glad to hear you say that even you have trouble keeping all the pipeline projects straight, because and I think it's been interesting, because obviously on the national scene, the Keystone pipeline was a huge issue for many years. That's an oil pipeline. We're talking about gas pipelines today. But and then more recently, we had the Dakota Access pipeline that you mentioned. And now there's sort of been an explosion of resistance to a lot of different pipelines all across the country. So I'm wondering, and I'll throw this out to all of you if anyone wants to dive in. So why do you think we've seen the controversy over fracking or shale gas development in particular shift to controversy over pipelines? What's driving that?
Anybody want to jump in?
All right, let me try to take this. So again, you know, why now? So one of the things that struck me as I was driving here using my gasoline-powered vehicle and thinking about climate change and thinking about other kinds of issues is that back around 10 years ago, 12 years ago, if you were to be looking at issues relating to energy development and what people were concerned about, there wasn't really, I mean, the word fracking really didn't come up. The word pipelines really didn't come up. Instead, what people were concerned about was wind. And so wind power, and I do environmental consulting, and a few years ago, one of my projects was a wind project that ran into some real turbulence, in northeastern Pennsylvania, pun semi intended. And there were people who were just dead set against the wind farm, this particular wind farm being built. And the thing that I was really struck with was to what degree they were using half-truths, non-truths, character assassination, you know, any trick in the book to basically try to get their end across. And their end across was basically to stop this wind project. And actually it turned out that they were successful, and this is something that got me as a scientist interested in public discourse and the public interaction between science and decision making. And so as I was driving here, I really was thinking about the fact that if you were to go back maybe 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, and look at newspaper articles about natural gas pipelines, and certainly natural gas pipelines have been around for a long period of time, that people weren't at all really concerned about these pipelines that were being put in. Certainly northeastern Pennsylvania, where I grew up, I didn't really hear any complaints about all these pipelines that might have been going in, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And so I think that with the fury that came about 10, 8 to 10 years ago with regard to fracking, and it seemed that a lot of the activist groups were losing the battle on fracking, especially in Pennsylvania. Now, again, in New York, it's New York State, it's a different story. But in Pennsylvania, basically the companies just went ahead and fracked. And so then it seemed that there was a shift among the activist groups, and I do interact with a lot of people who are environmental activists, and a lot of the fury then switched from the actual well pads and the actual fracking process to natural gas pipelines. And I think that there was a realization that pipelines serve as a choke point for natural gas development. And, you know, the industry will claim that a lot of the development of natural gas is being hampered. You know, there's a lot of what we call stranded gas, simply because they can't get the gas to market. And so they need to build a lot more new pipelines. And so, the idea here is that activists realized that if they could choke off pipeline development, that would actually go a long way with ending fracking entirely. And so that's where I see that a lot of attention has been devoted to, within the past 3 to 4 years, has really been devoted to these pipelines, when in contrast, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, more than that, nobody gave a hoot about pipelines, and now everybody seems to care. Yeah. And it's really interesting.
Marie, did you want to do it? I just want to chime in that this is also why are people concerned and are angry about it? It's because there's been a huge amount of development. We went from the beginning of the century thinking we were running out of natural gas to building import terminals to now we have more gas than we know what to do with and we're going to export it. So there's been a huge amount of development, and it's also been in places that historically haven't seen it. So even though Pennsylvania was home to the dawn of the global oil industry, we haven't had a lot of development and drilling until the past 10 years. And it was new to people. And it also just touches a lot of people's lives because it's a very dispersed infrastructure. So unlike, you know, building maybe a power plant that, you know, people in the town might get mad about that, this is just all over the place. It's a well here, it's a compressor station there, it's a pipeline there. And especially when it comes to pipelines, because the threat of eminent domain is always hanging over you, people feel like they're really being pushed around and they feel like they lack agency. And the commission, FERC, which I mentioned before, just really has a track record of pretty much approving every pipeline that comes before it. In the past 30 years, they've rejected 2 proposals. And what I heard from them is that, you know, essentially, if the companies dot all their I's and cross all their T's and do what they're supposed to do, they're going to get through the process. You know, one industry executive compared it to me to graduating from high school. You know, some kids might flunk out and not do what they're supposed to do, but if you do what you're supposed to do, you will get that FERC certificate and you will get authorization. So when people see the threat of eminent domain hanging over their property, they feel like, well, this commission just has a track record of approving everything that comes before it.
And I think 10 to 15 years ago, we didn't have all of the information at hand. It's a relatively new process, so we didn't have the information about the adverse health impacts. We didn't have the information about the climate impacts. And that was one of the key turning points in Maryland, was all of the John Hopkins studies that came out that were citing all the impacts from fracking. And as far as pipelines, it's not just pipelines. As she said, it's also a compressor station. It's all of the infrastructure that goes along with that. And I don't think, you know, one of the families I work with really closely is a farming family in West Virginia, the Keysuckers, who have had their land for over 7 generations, that were just dragged into court the day we launched our rolling encampment, and lost their land to eminent domain. And they don't want a pipeline on their property. They're farmers, they're poor, they're rural, and losing a portion of that land is definitely going to impact their bottom line. And who wants to hand down that land to the next generation? And I think that's where some of the outcry, it's not just that people are just now mad about pipelines, they're really realizing all of the impacts that frack gas and frack gas infrastructure has on their livelihood, on their health, and all of those other things.
And I would add, though, that's part of the misinformation. I'm a third-generation farmer, and I have pipelines on my property, and I'm still able to farm the land that the pipeline is under. So to say that they're going to lose a portion of the land is not factually correct. Now, they might not be able to plant deep-rooted trees, but if they're planting crops, you still have that availability. And certainly with modern techniques, when it comes to the impact of farming, the way that you separate the soil and keep the topsoil on one side, the subsoil on the other, you bring them back in, you still have that opportunity. Plus, during the time of construction, whatever crop you were planting or whatever crop you will say that you plan to plant, you will receive fair market-based compensation plus, so you don't lose the income even during that construction period or during the growth period. And if for some reason that section were to become non-usable, again, contractually and legally, we as a pipeline company would have to compensate that individual. So now I won't dispute any of the science that you want to say as far as feelings and emotion about what the impact might be of different infrastructure, but to characterize it to say that it's a loss of income for that family, that would be a mischaracterization. If I were running the opposition's campaign, I probably would focus on pipelines too. But I think part of the debate and the tactics that are used lead to things like eminent domain, and that's why that tool is there. Lancaster's against pipeline. I mean, one of the things they did was they built a fake cemetery. So then they created a controversy with a fake cemetery that you're going to go through a cemetery area, a burial plot, and all the sensitivities associated with it. And I'm not saying it's fair or not. It's very creative. However, it creates a dialogue of distrust between, which, quite frankly, leads a judge sometimes to grant eminent domain because they're not quite sure what's real and what's not. So I think if we actually had open and honest dialogue, we could probably come to better compromises. On that particular project on Atlantic Sunrise, if you look at the different moves that were made in the adjustment of the plan based on the community outcry, at the end of the day, in several years of delay or months of delay, that pipeline came back within something like 90% of the original route that was assessed for that pipeline. And it's because you have professionals who are working on these projects and they have been engaged for so long that they do live here. They are part of the community, and they don't want to destroy the land either. So they come up with an assessment and a route that they think is going to have the least impact, and they also want to get something based on the least impact that could be approved. But the point was, after all the changes were made, then one of the original groups that fought for changes sued Williams Company to get the pipeline routed back to the original route because they agreed finally that that was the best route. The original one would have impacted 7 farms and families, and the redirected one that got approved would have been 27 farms and families. And ultimately, everybody agreed 7 was better than 27 if the pipeline were going through, and could it go back to the original thing? So, again, that's where I think we need to have open and honest dialogue. You might want to add to that.
I think did you choose to have the pipelines on your land because they didn't have a choice? So that's one of the things, I do want to bring up.
We didn't have a choice.
So your land was taken by eminent domain.
No, we were compensated for it.
Okay. So they didn't have a choice. They didn't want this. They didn't ask for this. They can't run, as far as I know, they can't run heavy farm machinery over where you're going to be constructing the pipeline. And so that's – and in the case of the Eastern Panhandle Expansion Project, it's actually – it's a backup source of electricity and a source of energy. And West Virginia, because of the way their laws are built, energy companies can actually charge people in advance for future projects. So it's not actually that there's a need for this project. And so these folks are losing their land. And I think that's where some of the controversy comes in. And it comes into landowners' rights. And that's a big, big part of it. And people have the right to say, I don't want this on my land. I want to keep my family healthy. I don't want the risk of an explosion. And I don't think it's fair to say that we're mischaracterizing it and propping these things up when these are real people fighting for their homes.
And I think, obviously the consumer at the end, if they don't have electricity or there's power that's not generated, I think they may argue that their lives are impacted by not having enough energy.
So when they did their feasibility study, one of the things that Mountaineer Gas promised the residents that would be impacted by the pipeline was that they would, do all of the upgrades that they needed to their homes in order to hook them up to the pipeline, which they've since reneged on and aren't going to be able to access that energy. So what benefit is it to those communities if they're not actually benefiting directly from those pipelines and it's going to be served as a backup source? And a lot of these pipelines actually aren't going to be fully functioning. I mean, you profit from just building them in the infrastructure, especially in West Virginia.
Well, it's a couple of things, and I'll speak from a Pennsylvania perspective. First off, a utility is managed by the PUC, the Public Utility Commission. And you have a territory that you're assigned as that natural gas utility. So unless there's a natural gas utility willing to take on those customers, a pipeline producer can't add customers online because they don't have the billing capabilities. Now, that's, again, where a cooperative relationship should take place, that just as if you were putting in an interstate or a new road project. I mean, when I was a kid, I remember we were driving on Route 30 through Lancaster County, and that was the road, and you went through Dutch Wonderland, and everything was wonderful, and you get through, and then the turnpike was expanded, and you missed Dutch Wonderland. But then they put an exit there, so I could ride on the turnpike, and I can still get off. I think with a cooperative relationship between local government as well as state government, with, say, in Pennsylvania, the DCED, where you could actually put that T on the pipeline and have access to it at some point. The way I usually explain it is, if I want to put a bay window in my house, the best time to discuss it is when I have the architect there and design it and it's built first. Because if I have to knock out a brick wall after that house is built and put in that bay window, it's more difficult. But if we were to do real assessment of land use and you put in that particular spot from a local government perspective where a utility, should they get a charter to serve that particular area, they would be able to do it. But as the pipeline company, they would not be able to have those customers on that line. It would have to be managed by a utility.
Can I just want to chime in and say, when you talk about the use of the natural gas and who gets to use it, it absolutely infuriates a lot of people that this stuff's being exported. I mean, the U.S. is awash in natural gas, and we're projected to produce more than we consume by next year, according to the EIA. So there's a, you know, an LNG liquefied natural gas terminal in Louisiana that's been shipping. And there's one supposedly starting shipments next month, I hear, the Cove Point Terminal in Maryland, that really angers people because even if it helps the U.S. geopolitically, again, it's like very localized. You're tearing up my backyard and you're going to send it overseas. That just infuriates people, even people who are supportive of the industry. Like when I first started hearing about shale, I lived in Wyoming at the time, and I remember it was T. Boone Pickens commercials. I don't know if they were aired around the country, but I saw them all the time. And, you know, in his drawl, it was like, natural gas is cheap, abundant, and it's ours. And it was all about American energy independence. Mm-hmm. So that was part of the marketing to people of what this means for America. And when people see it going abroad, they get really mad about it.
And that's an unusual dynamic in that you have either it's the keep it in the ground side. So if you're in the keep it in the ground camp, then you don't care if it's used or not, and that's really not your agenda. If you're on the use side, you know, that's certainly something that could be embraced. I drive a CNG natural gas Tahoe, and I tell people all the time the two places I can't fill it up, Washington, D.C., and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And if we were to embrace the use of it, then that certainly diminishes the need for export, and you could find ways to do it. Now, that's not getting into the argument for keeping it in the ground, because obviously that would not be your goal, but if it's here and we wanted to embrace it. You look at, for example, the Postal Service just did the largest vehicle purchase in the United States history, something like a $6 billion buy. Anybody have an idea how many natural gas vehicles or alternative fuel vehicles they purchased? Throw a number out? Yeah. Someone say zip? Yeah. Let's just say from a policy perspective, if we wanted to push electric vehicles or natural gas vehicles, if they would have made that decision to go to a General Motors or a Ford or a Chevy or whoever the contract would ultimately get and say, we would like alternative fuel vehicles, what would that do for the cost of everybody else purchasing an alternative fuel vehicle? And what would that do for, you know, the environment where these vehicles would operate? And this is when I talk about why we have a need for a national energy policy. You look at the DOD's energy plan, and there's not a mention of alternative fuel vehicles in their plan, but yet we'll send them out to war so they could go to areas of conflict to secure carbon fuels for somebody else, but yet they don't do things to change their own policy internally.
Okay. And I'm going to shift us on to a new, little bit of a new topic here. So, Brooke, I'm wondering what you can tell us about the kinds of people who've been getting involved in the fights against pipelines. There's a stereotype of environmental activists as white and wealthy and privileged. And does that accord with what you've been seeing on the ground as you've been organizing?
No. And that was, I come from a labor background, so that was my opinion of environmentalists too, so I'll just full disclosure. And so, but through this work, I really, it does take a lot of work to have all the voices in the room, and so I feel that the environmental community, especially working with more and more frontline communities, has seen our movement grow and be more diverse. And there's still a lot of work and intentional work that needs to be done to make sure that all the voices in the room are being heard. But I found with our clean energy campaigns and our fracking campaigns that we've worked on that we've had just such diverse folks come in. And especially in Western Maryland, where it's a more rural area. And people, it's more of like an economically distressed region. So we've seen a lot of landowners come out. We've seen a lot of low-income communities come out and say that they were against us. I've worked with the Maryland State Conference of the NAACP. They've become avid supporters. They're going to be at our Hands Across the Potomac event on Saturday. And then, you know, just last night I received a call from the Allegheny County and NAACP wanting to come out. And so we see more and more diverse groups coming out, and that's what it takes in order to win these different types of campaigns. Is you need a big tent, because it can't be the typical white upper class environmentalist, because lawmakers don't want to see you all every time, because they know that these are the typical suspects. And one of the things that we did when we ran our fracking ban campaign was we really worked across the state. So it wasn't just Western Maryland that would be immediately impacted. But we worked all the way, you know, in Baltimore City. They were one of the first places to pass a resolution, because we talked about how is this going to impact your air? How is this going to impact your health? And we talked about the environmental justice impacts of it. These well pads and things like that are normally placed in either communities of color or low income communities. And so I think we had to have that knowledge come out about environmental justice, and that helped to bridge that gap. We've also been working really closely with faith communities, and that's been a really important constituency that we've had. And we do, you know, this is our third year in Maryland doing a program called Climate in the Pulpits, where we ask faith communities to engage their congregation on our priority issues and to talk about caring for creation. And so I think it's really important not only to not kind of gloss over those voices, but for if you're an activist, and most of you are journalists, but to really intentionally start to reach out to those communities and to do that education one by one. I know in Frostburg it was literally a door-to-door campaign. In the Eastern Panhandle, they've collected over 2,000 petitions right now, and that is not an easy feat because it is not densely populated areas. So it's more of that community, making sure you're intentionally reaching out to communities to get them engaged in this campaign. And when people have the education and when people have the knowledge, people act. And we're finding that as more and more environmental organizations reach out and just make the strides to intentionally organize in those communities, that people normally come along. It was, I'll never forget, Delegate Buckle telling me, you know, half of this, we were sitting in a Frostburg City Council meeting and there was about 300 people there. And he said, you know, 3/4 of these people voted for Trump. And I was like, that's fine. 3/4 of these, it was like every single person in this room doesn't want fracking in their community. So regardless of whether they lean more conservative or whether they're rural, that we can't discount those voices, and we need to bring those voices to the forefront.
Thanks. Well, that's sort of a good segue into my next question, which is about politics. There are some really sort of mixed up and interesting politics around fracking and pipelines. So here in Pennsylvania, there's a Democratic governor, Tom Wolf, who's been very supportive of the gas industry. South of us in Maryland, we have a Republican governor, Larry Hogan, who banned fracking this spring. North of us in New York, we have a Democratic governor, Andrew Cuomo, who has presidential aspirations. So he banned fracking and has been pushing back against some pipeline projects. You know, at the same time, as one of the experts on the fracking tour some of us went on yesterday mentioned, New York State is the largest consumer of shale gas. And, you know, in Virginia, there's a governor's race going on, and one contentious issue there is a couple of natural gas pipelines. In this case, the Democrat, Ralph Northam, has tried to stay neutral on that. What do you guys make of all the confusing politics around shale gas development and pipelines.
Marie, you
Oh, yeah. I'll chime in because I am from Pennsylvania, so I'm living back home now, but I worked in Albany, New York for 2 years before coming back home. And at least what I've seen with the New York example is, to me, that is New York, it's NIMBYism. It's definitely like, we don't want this extraction in our backyard. There's also, you know, but again, they consume a lot of natural gas. So also though, I would say working in Albany when I was there, there were anti-fracking protesters in the state capitol almost every day, lots of them. And in Harrisburg, you just don't have that. And what I find the different sort of populations and how the level of political activism in New York was, to me, just as an observer, a lot higher. And in Pennsylvania, where I live in Lancaster, which is not, you know, Marcellus Shale is not underneath us. It stretches, you know, in the western part of the state and up north. Most of the population center for Pennsylvania is Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, but then there are a lot of people where I live in the south central area. And I still talk to people all the time who've never heard of the Marcellus Shale, and I'm just astounded. And people who are organizing against the Atlantic Sunrise Pipeline in Lancaster, I know there just wasn't that level of engagement when the drilling was happening up in the northern tier. So it was, what I'm seeing is it's sort of suddenly like it's touching me, it's touching my life, it's touching my community, and I care, which is normal and natural. But in New York, there were literally people, busloads of people coming up from the city all the time to Albany, making a lot of noise. So there's just different levels of engagement, I think. And with New York, I do, watching it from both sides of the borders, I do feel like, you know, sure, we'll take your gas, we'll burn your gas, but we don't want those drill rigs and those frackers in New York.
And I would, obviously, for those who don't, Seneca Resources is part of National Fuel Gas Company. We're the only company left in North America that has everything from the drill bit to the burner tip. We have the exploration side. We have the pipeline or midstream company that's part of the parent group, and 738,000 utility customers, mostly in northwestern Pennsylvania and the western side of New York. And so, you know, we do see it from all sides. We were one of the companies that had a pipeline project denied, and, you know, certainly had impact. But we also, knowing that we serve that number of utilities, that makes us one of the top 20 largest natural gas utility companies in the country, and you have an obligation to serve those customers. When we talk about the ability to serve, and even when you look at the clean energy, I have a friend of mine, I tell people I advocate for agricultural and energy because of my farming background and then, you know, working in the industry, that I was listening to someone who was an egg producer talking about having natural eggs versus the regular eggs and the organic, and he said that his job is just to provide eggs for all the people who want to consume eggs at whatever level of consumption they want. Now, if you're able to pay $5 a dozen for organic eggs, then good for you. But if you're the person on a fixed income and you can't afford $5 a dozen eggs and you still want eggs, it's good to have that opportunity. And I think when you look at energy, it's somewhat very similar, that we could have more expensive energy alternatives, but can those other people on the other end of the economic scale afford it? I do take exception to what you said about imposing on the poor. There's a reason why they used to call this Appalachia. I mean, people are familiar with this term. We have the Appalachian Poverty Line for those who grew up in western Pennsylvania. It's not so much that energy is imposing on the poor. The area has always been historically lower income in certain pockets in the Appalachian Poverty District, but that also happens to be the location where natural gas is located. So certainly that infrastructure will be there. So it's not as if they've been imposed on. That's where the resource is, and that area always had some certain economic disparities. So, again, but there's wealth opportunities that come with that. There's job opportunities that come with that. And certainly there's a risk that comes with that as well. Most of you don't know me, don't know my background. I was sharing it with some people in the room last night. I spent some time in San Diego, and I found myself financially challenged. And I had a really good apartment. It fit my couch. It was a storage unit. And at night, I would come back to there because it was a gate access, and I could sleep in that storage unit. Average temperature in San Diego was about 72 degrees. And during that time, I found ways to eat. Like, I'd go, there's always food in the office, so I could go into the office and I could get Tupperware and I could get food and I could eat and I'd live, and it wasn't that bad. So I don't say it as a hardship story, it's just like a learning experience. One thing I learned from that when I apply it here is I never want to be cold or hungry again. And I look at the individuals that you have, and I think somewhere in between is a good balance between reasonably priced energy and reasonable develop with the environmental protections mm-hmm. that you seek. And I think that should always be the goal and always part of that discussion.
So I don't think compressor stations are part of where natural resources are located. And I also don't think, like, the fracked water waste disposal isn't part of, like, where it's naturally done. So I disagree with you on imposing on low-income communities. But I did want to get back to the political question. So I think very similar to New York, it's because we had so much outcry and so much activism. I think the Democrats in Maryland really wanted to kick fracking down the road another year to make it an election issue. And we knew that this was – our moratorium was running out in October of 2018, which would have allowed for them to start permitting leases. And so we really saw last year's legislative session as our chance to really ban fracking and to put it to bed once and for all. And unfortunately, our Democratic leadership read that wrong. And they had introduced a bill that would have virtually allowed fracking in Maryland, where they were going to ban it for two, put a moratorium on it for 2 years, and then allow a county by county vote after that 2 year moratorium, because their philosophy was, well, we'll just ban it in 22 out of 24 counties, and the counties that want it, Garrett and Allegheny County, would be able to have it. And we knew that that would bring fracking to Maryland. And so what we did was we organized municipality by municipality, and we had over 14 municipal bans and resolutions, like resolutions in support of a statewide ban. And I think Governor Hogan, although we may not agree on everything, was really savvy and saw the big power of our grassroots movement. We had over 800 grassroots activists lobby throughout session. We had 1,000 people marching in the streets. And he read the writing on the wall that he could use this vote to his political advantage. If any of you saw that news conference, we were all very startled. I thought it was actually a joke. I had just gotten arrested the day before, and so one of my colleagues for the fracking ban, called and said, Governor Hogan is announcing that he's supporting the fracking ban. And I just hung up on him, and he called me back, and he's like, no, I'm serious. And I hung up on him again, and he's like, turn on your internet. And that's when he made the announcement. And I think it was that he was smart enough to see that there was a large enough movement behind this that it would help him to get reelected. And unfortunately, our Democratic leadership didn't see this or wanted to use it, saw the momentum, and wanted to use that in our upcoming elections as a wedge issue to bring people out to the polls. Unfortunately, you know, Governor Hogan turned the tide on that, because one of the things we heard and one of the biggest challenges that we were up against was that we didn't have a veto-proof majority. And so the head of our Senate Environmental Committee wasn't going to actually put the fracking ban to a vote in her committee unless we had that 29 votes. And so Governor Hogan making that announcement and taking that veto-proof majority question off of the table is really what propelled us. But it really was grassroots activism. The oil and gas industry spent over $1.3 million lobbying in those 3 months against trying to support, you know, the moratorium bill. Well, my budget was a lot more modest. And so I really do think for, like, political, it really is how much outcry people have and how active they are. And we also learned lessons from Pennsylvania and West Virginia and all of those, you know, stories were emerging about contaminated wells and water, and had folks come down there and speak to us and really educate us and get us activated. So I think that's where the different political shifts come in.
All right, if I could just jump in with one other very quick comment. I know you want to get to the audience here, but one of the things that I see is that Governor Wolf is actually a little bit less embracing of natural gas than his predecessor was, Governor Corbett. You know, Governor Corbett was very gung-ho on fracking. And, you know, I think one of the indicators there was that his the head of the Department of Environmental Protection really saw his role as really advocating for the industry. And now, you know, at least with the two DEP heads that we've had under Wolf, I think that there's more of a skepticism toward the industry, and I think there's a more willingness to heavily regulate the industry, but not drive it out entirely. So I just wanted to add that point.
Yeah, thank you. All right, yeah, we do want to open it up to questions from the audience. Again, we want to give preference to the people with blue badges, the journalists and SEJ members in the room. So let me start in the very back. Yeah, please. Oh, can you tell us your name and what outlet you represent?
Yes, my name is Mary Ellen, and I cover science and the environment for the Columbus Dispatch.
Okay.
I'm wondering how spills during a pipeline construction, and this may be more frequent, how do you cover that, and how does that change the story in terms of pollution that's happening while it's possible?
Okay, so I'll repeat the question because we are recording this session. So our reporter from Ohio is asking about how do you cover pipeline spills when they hit?
Yeah, well, that's been happening quite a bit on the Mariner project. As you may know, my colleagues in Philadelphia have covered that a bit more than I have. But I think you just go out and cover it, right? I mean, if people have to be put up in a hotel room because their private water well is messed up, then you go out and cover it. But again, I mean, always try to put the whole thing in context, right? Like, so how often does this happen? Is this normal? You know, people are really angry about it, but was the state regulatory agency doing its due diligence when it, you know, permitted some of this stuff? I mean, yeah, you got to cover it, right? It's if people are impacted.
Let's see. Mike from E&E?
Hey, I'm Mike Leon with E&E News. I cover pipelines and oil and gas regulation. Marie touched on the she called it the sense of agency, the power imbalance between the industry and landowners. I'd like to hear from Rob, you know, is there anything the industry or the legislators can do to, you know, fix that power imbalance? I'd like to hear from Brooke if the power imbalance gets fixed.
Okay, so our question is about the power imbalance between the energy industry or the industry when they want to build pipelines and people whose property might be taken for those pipelines via eminent domain. So, Rob, do you want to start off there?
You look at Atlantic Sunrise Project, since we've talked about that one, and I'm a little bit more familiar with that particular project. You go through a process in which you are negotiating with the landowners. I can tell you, on the majority of pipeline projects, you probably have 80% of the people along that right-of-way who will actually negotiate, and I won't necessarily use the word fine, but they've accepted, they're going through, and they're not going to fight that project. And then you start working through that last group of folks. Usually at the end of the day, you'll get down to a handful of people who are truly holding out, and that's where the eminent domain process kicks in. I think that people sometimes lose sight that it is a law that pipeline companies use, but it's a law that's applicable to other projects, whether it's a Walmart coming in, whether it's a road construction project or a road widening project. And, you know, there are certain reasons why the law came to be, and there are certain ways that you use it. I think, like anything else, you want to negotiate fairly. And you also have that tool that's out there, and I think that should always be the first part where you start. I think from a legislative perspective, even though certainly on a interstate pipeline, FERC has jurisdiction, you have DOD, you are a Department of Transportation, you have Army Corps of Engineers, but the states truly wield a lot of power, as you can see with Northern Access, that 401 permit that was denied after all the other approvals were there, that they still have a certain level of control and can negotiate with it. So I think there are some elements of it there, obviously, though, but eminent domain is the last thing that you're looking to do. You hope to have amicable settlements with everyone.
Can you tweak that system?
I think you could.
How?
Well, I think part of it is to understand the process that's involved. I think the states generally don't because, again, the mishmash of how many people have jurisdiction. I mean, for example, in Pennsylvania, not only are you dealing with the DEP, but you're dealing with each regional office that a project goes through and the interpretations that they may have of applicable law or how they're going to put that forward. And so those things come into come into play. And how do you make that more even for us and, you know, get it so it's implemented equally across the state?
I would say you should tweak that system quite a bit. So one of the things that a lot of landowners deal with is just constant harassment from surveyors, and they don't know how to deal with it. They don't know what their rights are. And we've really seen in, like, we formed a group called Communities of Communities of folks that deal with natural gas infrastructure. So I think, you know, any, like, legislation that should come up should deal with that. Like, how is the community notified? For instance, where I am in Hagerstown, a lot of folks didn't even know that the pipeline was going to be coming to a water source that's 10 miles away. They still don't know. We're trying to revamp that. But there needs to be greater education of the community. So I know that Mountaineer Gas came in, but just what can letting people know the risk, letting people know what their rights are for surveyors and things like that. And then I think letting people make an educated decision on whether or not they want that on their land, because a lot of the time there's a lack of education and there's a lack of notification about what the consequences are. And then if they can make an informed, educated decision after having all of the facts, after being able to take some time and working with the company and government agencies to go forward that way. I would say that would be up to the landowners. Like, our philosophy for my group and for myself is to keep it in the ground. But if a landowner is able to make an informed decision, knows of all of the risks from start to finish, knows that they can change the source of what's running through those pipelines, if the community knows that a compressor station might be coming down the line and knows that, you know, they might not be compensated if something goes away on that and they still are paying taxes on that property. So I think as long as all of that education is getting out there, then landowners should be able to make the decision on what they want to do with their land.
Again, the very back row.
I did a story about FERC over the summer in July with in collaboration with the Center for Public Integrity. So you can go check that out if you want. It aired on NPR. It's on NPR.
Oh, I saw that. That's right. That's right. But that was one of the few I saw.
Yeah. So, So my recommendation to covering FERC, well, I mean, you said you're in
Michigan.
You're in Michigan. Well, so you're a little bit – you're far away. But I think – so I think FERC is actually starting to get a lot more attention. The spotlight is suddenly shining on it. I don't think it's an agency a lot of people had never heard of until this pipeline boom. But the one agency I would urge people to cover more when you talk about it going near a daycare, or I assume people are concerned about an explosion or something, is PHMSA, which is the Pipeline and Hazardous Material Safety Administration. It's part of the U.S. Department of Transportation. And people have reported on it. And Politico actually did an article about it a couple years ago. It's severely under-resourced, underfunded. They have about 200 people for the nation's 2.7 million miles of pipeline.
Can you repeat the title?
PHMSA. P-H-S-M. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. And I actually wrote this down because I think it just speaks to their sort of general lack of dealing with safety. They, until last year, if you went on their website and looked at their mission statement, their goal was to reduce pipeline death and injury incidents to 26 to 37 incidents per year. Their goal was... That was their goal, which I talked to a guy from the FAA, which more people know, and he's like, our goal is zero plane crashes a year. That doesn't mean planes don't crash. Things happen. But if your goal is 26 to 37 deaths a year, they just changed the website, by the way. I went and used that. I don't know if any of you use the Internet Wayback Machine where you plug in a URL. You can go do it and read what their goals were. But they're just, I would say, a mess. And again, I think it's important to put this in context that we have 2.7 million miles of pipelines, and most days they don't explode and they don't kill people. And, you know, we all, many of us use natural gas and we're fine. But as this build out goes on, I think that agency just needs a lot more attention. Like, there was even a report that came out last month from, came out in August from the Government Accountability Office that basically said, since they have so few people, they have to prioritize, you know, where are we going to send inspectors? You know, we have, you know, a couple hundred people for millions of miles. And the model that they use to model, like, where to go and how to prioritize risk and inspections, they couldn't explain the rationale behind the model. They don't test the model to make sure it's effective. Like, they couldn't even explain how they prioritize inspections or assess risk. So FERC is getting more attention, so I encourage you to keep an eye on what FERC is doing. But I think more journalists should dig into PHMSA and see why it's so poorly resourced.
Yes.
Hi. Well, I'm Emily Horn with the News Review in Southern Oregon, and there's a Canadian company proposing a pipeline to run through there by natural gas. Well, it'll be natural gas and then liquefied on the coast to be shipped to Asian markets. And FERC did deny them in 2015, but now they're back reapplying. And so, FERC, you brought up a lot of points that landowners have brought up, and Robert, you brought up a lot of points that the company has made. And so I report both of those sides, but I want to be sure to point to peer-reviewed studies or examples that are similar, like things that have happened in other communities that I can point to and say, this is what happened here, and this is kind of what this might look like in the future. Are there sources like that that you can both agree on that are factual and
Well, okay, so we have a question from a journalist in Oregon who's been covering a proposed LNG project there and is asking about, we hear from landowners and opponents, we hear from industry, but is there, you know, good research that we could report on or that journalists could report on? So actually, I'm going to throw that to Ken first.
Oh, boy.
Our scientist.
All right. So when I was involved in trying to finalize our reports to the DOE, that was something I actually got into, was the, I don't know what you call it, the epidemiology the risk assessment of, natural gas pipelines. And so, there is a literature, although I think it's mainly I don't want to call it a gray literature, but it's a literature that is mainly in the form of government reports and industry reports, that do report on, the risk of pipeline rupturing and number of people who are killed and actually I'm surprised that the number that you reported was the goal was as high as you said it was.
26 to 37.
Yeah, I thought what I'm led to believe by reading literature is that it's much lower than that. I think in terms of actual peer-reviewed studies, I'm not really aware of that literature, but I know that government reports and industry reports, there's quite a bit out there, and if you do a Google Scholar search, I think that might be able to help you find some of the literature on that.
So I'll follow up on that quickly, because Ken, I think one of the points that you made when you and I were talking is that there just isn't really enough good science out there about pipelines, and that more should be being done. I don't know if you want to address this quickly.
So I can talk at length about this, but I won't.
Talk it brief.
I won't. I'll talk in brief. And so, again, as we look at the, especially the environmental impacts of energy development in general, there is quite a bit of information out there, obviously, on coal mining. You know, we know a lot about that. We know a lot about power lines. And we know a lot about, fracking pads, you know, what well pads do, to waters and terrestrial ecosystems. But it seems that there is a blind spot in terms of the number of peer-reviewed papers that appear as it relates to natural gas pipelines. There are a few, but really not that many. One of the things also, just as an interesting story, is that, you know, we've been looking for funding for our research, and we've actually had some difficulty trying to find funding. And, you know, we're trying not to take industry funding, you know, for this. We're trying to go with federal funding, and there just doesn't seem to be that much in the way of federal funding out there. And so when we go to companies, you know, if we were to want to go to companies looking for funding, they would basically tell us, well, there's no real need for us to fund your research because our consultants tell us that natural gas pipelines are really safe. And so we don't really need anybody to tell us that, you know, what we already know. And then when we go to the foundations, or when we go to the activist communities, they say, well, we already know that natural gas pipelines are destroying the world, and so there's no real need for us to fund any of your research because, you know, you're already telling us. And so, again, there's this idea of something called metacognition, which is knowing what you know, and I think in many cases, people don't know what they think they know about natural gas pipeline development.
All right, thanks. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I'm just wondering if anyone could speak to natural gas exports just in the geopolitical sense.
I haven't
heard anything. Oh, I'm sure. Lainey Cook. I'm with KTC in South Louisiana.
Okay, so we're asking about the geopolitical impacts of exporting natural gas. Anybody want to jump
okay.
in?
Okay. So I teach a course in energy, and so that's one of the things that we get into some degree. And so I think that is a very large and maybe underreported aspect of natural gas development because, again, when people discuss the fact that we're exporting, you know, they look at this as being a negative thing that we're exporting natural gas. But really, it does give us clout in the world marketplace, if we could say that we're exporting natural gas to different countries, that then they will come to us and maybe not go to other countries that we would prefer that they don't go to. So there is that dimension that's there. And again, there is a literature, an economic literature on that and a, you know, geopolitical literature. But yeah, there is, that notion that it does give us standing in the world on that basis.
Okay. Second row there.
Hi, I'm Donna Morelli. I'm with the Bay Journal, and I'm located in Pennsylvania and follow Marie quite closely. One of the things I'm also from New York, from upstate New York, and just kind of wanted to clarify and reported on some of the pipeline issues in New York. And it's a really interesting dichotomy up there. It's a very poor community, upstate New York. Most people there don't have natural gas unless you live in a city. New York City definitely is where the usage is coming from, and the activism, some of it's coming from New York City and people busing it in like that, but there is a very environmental and I'm trying to think of the word I want to use for the community up there. Overall community of widespread, lots of open space, lots people live there because they like it the way it is. They don't live there because they're making money. I left because I couldn't get a job, or I'd still be there. I worked for the daily paper up there for years, and you know what happened with that. So I just wanted to, the reason the pipeline projects, and I know there's political stuff and there's pressure from New York City and there's activism. Some of those activists are local, but a lot of them are from New York City. When I reported on the pipeline project that just got turned down, it was turned down by a water quality certificate. They refused the water quality certificate, which means there was some science behind it. There was some research behind where the pipeline is going. There's a lot of pristine land up there. But just, you know, it's an underreported area, I think, in this story. Just that they banned it is usually what people talk about, and that they're turning down projects. But
yeah.
There's this dichotomy that landowners really, really could use the money. And also people who live in these diverse communities could really use the natural gas, but they're not getting it.
Okay.
Because it's a pipeline.
Yeah, no, that's okay. We probably only have time for one more question. Did you?
Just a quick question on the FERC issue. When FERC is rubber stamping something, is it because Congress gave it rules that are very lax, or is that the problem? And then the second question is, we talk about a lot of undersourced federal agencies, but we don't talk about Congress undersourcing it, right?
Right. So we have a question about FERC and why it's rubber stamping and funding for the agencies that are overseeing some of these issues.
I'll say when I was reporting on FERC this year that they wouldn't talk to us. So there's that. But I talked to a lot of former FERC people, and what they will tell you is they're not a rubber stamp. They have a narrow mandate in the law, and they feel like, hey, protesters outside the FERC building, if you have a problem with the Natural Gas Act, you should go down the street to Congress and have them change it. You know, it's, we don't have the ability, you know, again, if the companies do what they're supposed to do, like I said, dot all their I's and cross all their T's, then that's how they feel like we're going to issue the certificate. I will say the one interesting thing to read, which a lot of opponents of these pipelines point to, is when Norman Bay, the FERC chairman, was, right before he sort of abruptly resigned in February, throwing FERC into disarray because they no longer had a quorum and couldn't do work for months and months this year. He wrote a sort of memo on his way out about, you know, Google like Bay memo from FERC. And he laid out, you know, on his way out all the ways he thought FERC actually could improve its processes and bring more scrutiny, whether it's to the climate aspects of the project or the financial dealings of these projects. So. But yeah, they feel like they're limited by the law.
And just sort of like the 401 certification, that is what we're trying to use in Maryland to stop the Eastern Panhandle expansion project. So thank you for raising that. Unfortunately, New York has much more stringent rules over their 401 because it's different by each state. And so we're looking at that too. And that is the, we're hoping since Governor Hogan banned fracking that he would also, well, he didn't ban it, but spoke out against fracking, that he would also look to that to stop this pipeline as well.
Okay. Well, I want to thank all of you for coming, and a big thanks to our four panelists for taking the time to come here and present to us today. We really appreciate it.